Real estate, airplanes, and robots. Really, what more could you want? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 8th of March. Great, as always, to have you along, everybody. I think it's a rule of business journalism here in the 20-teens that a couple of times a year, at least, you got to make reference in one way or another to the financial crisis and the recession. I kid, but not really by very much, because the after effects are very real. We did get a sign today, though, another sign, really, that the housing crisis might firmly be in the rearview mirror. According to the research folks at CoreLogic, the number of homes in this country at some stage of the foreclosure process is at the lowest level we've seen since 2007, which is good, with a caveat, which Marketplace's Adrian Hill will provide right now.
Back in 2004, when the housing market was on fire, home ownership rates peaked at about 70%. We all know what happened next, and we had 8 million foreclosed homes to show for it. Now, the housing market is improving, but home ownership rates, the percentage of people who actually own the houses they live in, they haven't rebounded. They're at their lowest level in more than a quarter century. So where'd all those foreclosed homes go? Darren Bloomquist is an economist at RealtyTrack.
Foreclosures have been soaked up largely by investors buying up properties as rentals.
Basically, they took advantage of cheap housing and the fact that people who lost their homes still needed a place to live.
We saw a lot of the hedge funds and big private equity groups get into this business.
Frank Notaft is an economist with CoreLogic.
The number of single-family houses that were in the rental stock in 2006 was 9 million, increased by 3 million in the following 7 years.
That, in turn, drove down the supply of homes for sale and helped drive up prices in many markets around the country. Now, higher prices could make those investors and current homeowners more willing to sell, but...
So though the housing market has recovered, housing finance has not recovered.
Susan Wachter is a professor of real estate at the Wharton School. She says people who might normally consider buying or trading up are still struggling to get a mortgage. Renting may be the new normal. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Oscar Munoz, the CEO of United Airlines, United Continental Holdings, more accurately, is scheduled to get back to work full-time on Monday, that after a heart transplant at the beginning of the year. Capitalism knows no sympathy, though, and Munoz already has his hands full. United has been struggling since its merger with Continental, and now big-name investors and a former Continental CEO are calling for a shakeup. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more now on a good old-fashioned proxy fight.
United has a lot of things that should be going for it. Strong hubs in Chicago and San Fran, good position in the Pacific. But they have underperformed in terms of stock price for the past 5 years.
You know, if you're in a horse race and you're in fourth place, you're not winning.
That's Gordon Bethune, former CEO of Continental, speaking to CNBC.
United has the best employees, the best fleet, and the best route system. How come they're in fourth or fifth place?
All this underperforming has several investors very annoyed, specifically two hedge funds, Altimeter and PAR.
They paint themselves as long-term investors and not as activists.
That's Henry Hardeveldt with Atmosphere Research, a travel industry research company. The hedge funds want six new people on United's board, including Gordon Bethune, the old Continental CEO. Basically, they want to take over. United says, hold on, we're making progress.
More of its flights run on time. They've announced a series of investments to improve their airplanes and make their passenger experiences better. They've unveiled a new website.
Michael E. Levine is a professor at NYU Law. He says turning around an airline company is like turning around a ship.
A lot of people from outside the industry keep coming in and assume that the airline managements must be a bunch of doofuses because they just don't seem to be able to get it right. And then they discover how hard it is to get right.
But he says United's problems run deep and go far back. Shareholders will decide who wins the battle for control over United at the company's shareholder meeting in June. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
The New York Stock Exchange was founded 199 years ago today. The anniversary, I have to tell you, passed unnoticed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Roller coaster, seesaw, or completely normal, any of those phrases could legitimately be used to describe the ups and downs in the price of crude oil of late. Big picture, though, oil is well off its highs, the highs of the boom a couple of years ago, which has left tens of thousands of people in the oil patch out of work. Now, many of them are turning to the courts, saying that they weren't paid fairly when times were good. From KUNC, Dan Boyce has that story.
28-year-old oil driller Cody Armejo lives with his parents in Riverton, Wyoming. He's basically been out of work for a year. He keeps his long brown hair tied back with a bandana, and he's having ramen noodles for lunch.
I should have saved a lot more. I should not be in debt. I should have be debt-free and have, like, thousands in the bank, but I don't, you know?
Then, one day last winter, Armejo gets this letter about a class-action lawsuit saying Precision Drilling didn't pay him enough overtime when he worked for them.
Yeah, I was way surprised. I was like, what the heck? What's going on? I had no idea. I honestly had no idea.
As oil prices started dropping a year and a half ago, these lawsuits exploded. Armejo worked in Colorado. In that state last year, there were 9 times as many wage suits against oil and gas companies as there were in 2010. In Texas, the biggest oil state, nearly 10 times as many lawsuits. Federal records show oil and gas companies are among the top violators of wage laws, particularly by not paying overtime.
When you look at the work that the workers are doing, you're talking about 24-hour shifts. You're talking.
Tess Castilleja works with the U.S. Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division. She says oil workers' long hours put their employers at risk for a lot of wage violations if they're not paying close attention. Castilleja's office was seeing enough problems with this a couple of years ago. They decided to specifically investigate the oil and gas industry in some parts of the country. Since then, the office has recovered about $40 million in unpaid wages.
We have found cases where workers were not even paid the minimum wage because they're working so many hours. So the idea that they're being highly compensated, in some cases, they're not.
The biggest case her team has settled, by far, was against oil field services company Halliburton this past summer. In just this one case, they found Halliburton owed about 1,000 workers a total of $18 million. The company released a statement saying they, quote, worked earnestly and cooperatively with the Department of Labor to equitably resolve the situation.
It's the way the industry operates.
Brian Gonzalez is a Colorado lawyer who represents workers in these wage cases.
They see what their competitors are doing. They just do the same thing. And no one stops to say, well, hey, this isn't really compliant with the law.
Compliant, usually in the way they are classifying workers as being eligible for overtime or not. He believes for a lot of oil companies, this misclassification is a conscious business decision. The chance of getting caught is low. And he thinks in some cases,
even if they get sued, which is a big if, they'll pay a fraction of what they saved.
None of the companies we reached out to would agree to an interview for this story. Not Halliburton, not Precision Drilling, where Cody Armejo worked, not trade groups like the American Petroleum Institute, the National Association of Manufacturers, or the National Chamber of Commerce. In fact,
hi, Chad. This is Dan Boyce. I'm a public radio and television reporter in Denver.
We tried to reach every single company with a concluded case in Colorado from sometime in the past 5 years.
Please stay on the line and we'll be back in a moment.
No interviews. Cody Armejo is loading a four-wheeler into the back of a pickup to go shoot guns with some friends. He's got a lot of time on his hands.
I do a lot of hunting and fishing.
He ended up getting paid $6,000 in back wages from the class action lawsuit. That money's gone now, too. He says he would go right back to work in the oil field if he could, even knowing there's a chance he'd get paid less than what he's owed. In Denver, I'm Dan Boyce for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Well, you look at the best players in the world, the LeBron Jameses, the Steph Currys, and while they are the absolute best in the world at what they do, obviously they make mistakes. They miss shots, they throw bad passes, they make bad decisions.
Basketball and big data, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 0.6% today. 109 points closed at 16,964. The Nasdaq wiped out 1.25%, 59 points, finished at 4,648. The S&P 500 gave back 1.1%, 22 points, ended at 1979. Told you about the boardroom battle at United Continental. The airline's beleaguered stock fell another 2+%, but United looked like a high flyer compared to JetBlue. The discount airline took a 9% nosedive today after reporting fares and fees fell short last month, and more of the same is in store. Investors were not showing any financial firms the money. Morgan Stanley reversed 4%. Citigroup and B of A each withdrew more than 3% today. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A couple of weeks ago, the Federal Communications Commission reclassified broadband internet as a public utility, something all of us need to get along in our daily lives. Today, the FCC took another step, a plan to help low-income Americans afford broadband by picking up a part of their tab. It's an expansion of the FCC's Lifeline subsidy, which right now only applies to phone service. And the agency says in these digital times, that makes no sense. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more on that.
The FCC's Lifeline program gives those who already qualify for things like food assistance or Medicaid $9.25 a month for basic phone access. FCC Commissioner Mignon Clyburn says it's time that broadband and mobile data be included as well.
What we're talking about is providing choice. This is about expanding the menu, so to speak.
With some low-tier broadband plans already available for as little as $10, the subsidy would make them almost free. And it's not just customers that would benefit. Doug Brake of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation says many internet providers would get new business.
In urban low-income areas, the networks are already built. It's just a matter of identifying those consumers that $9.25 would make a real big difference in bringing them online.
But critics say the Lifeline program has a history of abuse, such as customers double-dipping. And telecom analyst James McQuivy of Forrester Research is worried about unintended consequences.
Are we actually slowing down the investment in the infrastructure because telcos have less reason to compete?
Because McQuivy says if companies get customers through subsidies, they'll have less incentive to get them by improving networks. The FCC's Mignon Clyburn says the immediate goal is access.
Our goal here is to allow our most vulnerable in this nation to realize that connectivity will open doors previously shut.
Clyburn says more than 13 million Americans could benefit from the broadband subsidy. In Chicago, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Here's really the only question left in professional basketball this season. After scoring his 300th three-pointer last night, can Steph Curry of the Golden State Warriors hit 400? Players like Curry are hard to come by, yes, but that doesn't stop the NBA from trying to make them by collecting and analyzing performance data of all kinds. Andy Glockner wrote about basketball and big data in his new book. It's called Chasing Perfection. Andy, it's good to have you on.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
There is a great line in this book that pretty much sums it up, I think. There are, you say, no perfect basketball players, but plenty of perfected ones. Explain that a little bit.
Well, you look at the best players in the world, the LeBron Jameses, the Steph Currys, and while they are the absolute best in the world at what they do, obviously they make mistakes. They miss shots. They throw bad passes. They make bad decisions. But the concept really is that the players that make the NBA are all exceptionally good at what they do. It's just that the superstars make it look so much easier than the rest of the guys that I think there's some dissonance for audiences looking at that.
All right, so take me now from the player to the team and throw in big data and analytics and how that really, as you say, has revolutionized basketball as we know it.
So there are so many different applications of the data, though. When people probably will think analytics is about how to get better shots, where your shots should be coming from, what combinations of players play together. There's a whole other world of this, though, with separate data being collected, which involves health and performance mm-hmm. and training and all that type of stuff that you do off the court that enables players to get bigger, faster, stronger, and most important, stay healthy, which is the biggest asset you can give to a team.
All right, so I'm mixing my sports here. But make the connection for me now to Moneyball, right? And that whole thing that Michael Lewis did with baseball, pointing out what Billy Beane and the Athletics had done, in some regard doing that, right? Signing those guys who can fill slots and get things done.
Yeah, I think the Moneyball concept has been beaten to death in a larger sense, where it was about on-base percentage being undervalued by the other teams in the market. Basketball is a much more complicated game than baseball, though. In basketball, you're dealing with 10 guys. And while there may only be a maximum of, say, three guys who are involved in a play in terms of, you know, box score scoring, there's an assist, a basket, the other seven players on the court are intimately involved in the success or failure of the play. Right. So capturing all of that and finding rhyme or reason in it is much different and much harder than just identifying what might be undervalued in a more linear sport like baseball.
Right. This is all this big data stuff and the way these things go. This is a business opportunity for companies out there, right, who want to provide this data to the teams. They want to provide it to the league, and they want to, you know, make some money while doing good for the sport, in theory.
These types of opportunities for these third-party companies are available because there's an inconsistency across the 30 NBA teams as to how much resources or how many resources they want to put into it, how much money they want to put into it. And there's a pretty big connection between the teams that are deeply into this and the teams that have been successful in the last two or three years.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to ask you. Translate now all this data and all this work that both the players and the teams do in your book, translate that to wins.
Well, that's the goal. So there's a lot of luck involved. There's a lot of development once you get your hands on things. I mean, you can identify a draft strategy and hit on a guy, but that doesn't mean that guy's going to be successful. Now you got to groom him. And he also has to play with the other players you have. I think analytics, like anything else in an organization, is a tool. And you need a smart organization to take advantage of the tools against the other organizations that might not be so sharp. So I don't think analytics leads directly to wins. I think team culture does.
Okay, so here comes the purity of sport question, and I will reveal my naivete here. Don't you just want guys to go out there and play some hoops and see who wins?
You'd be surprised by how many players don't pay a lot of attention to this fancy data. And they don't want to hear like, well, hey, you know what? You're kind of mediocre from this spot on the floor, because then it gets in their head. They start thinking about it. One of the biggest issues that teams continue to have in analytics is not the ability to decipher the data, but to communicate the data and have the parties that need to use the data buy into it.
Andy Glockner runs a site called The Cauldron. His new book on sports and basketball specifically and the data therein is called Chasing Perfection. Andy, thanks very much.
I appreciate the time. Thank you very much.
The trials and tribulations of the Japanese economy are pretty well known by this point. The lost decade, which actually turned out to be two, trade and currency gyrations, and for our purposes today, an aging workforce and an aging population overall. According to the World Bank, about a quarter of Japanese are over the age of 65, which by percentage makes it the oldest country in the world. And at the same time, the birth rate there is plummeting, which presents something of a problem, because traditionally in Japan, seniors have been cared for by their children. But with the elderly living longer and the young working more, what is to be done? Well, you'd be surprised, as Marketplace's Sally Herships reports.
Depending on your age, you may have had a conversation with your parents about how they want to be taken care of when they're older. But this particular question about who they want taking care of them may not have been on your list.
What would you rather, a foreigner or a robot?
じゃあ外国人にお世話してもらうとロボットに世話してもらうんだったらどっちがいいですか?
Hop a bullet train in Tokyo, ride for 6 hours towards the northeast, and you'll find the small city of Kamaishi. There, a group of women is sitting around a table, eating snacks at a weekly meeting for seniors. Japan is running out of caretakers for its elderly, and now seniors like these are facing that arguably strange question.
The first lady says, no, I don't want either. None of the choices apply. Okay, the second one, she says,
one solution is robots. We'll get to that soon. But if you were thinking this is a problem with an easy solution, Japan needs workers, people around the world need jobs, you need to know Japan often gets accused of xenophobia. The Japanese have been reluctant to let in outsiders. Here's how one of the women described her neighbor from the Philippines. Even though the neighbor spoke Japanese,
but still, she wasn't Japanese. And for us, I wouldn't deny that there was a little bit of a strangeness between her, and there was a slight distance between her and the rest of us. So for us to accept that kind of foreign aid might be a little bit difficult.
Whatever you call it,
Only 1.5% of the country's population is made up of immigrants. And now Japan is stuck, short of workers. All you have to do is visit a nursing home in Tokyo to see. The Keijukai Senior Citizen Home may be halfway around the world, but it looks a lot like one of its American counterparts. Residents are sitting in wheelchairs, watching TV. There are tissue paper flowers on the walls. There's even Jell-O for lunch. But there's one key difference. There's a waiting list to get in, and it is a long one.
Hi, これです。Here it is.
This whole thing is from 1 month?
No. The list is 8 pages long. If you're on it, you could be waiting for years. The home's manager, Hirofumi Yamada, says every month, local governments send out lists like these to nursing homes around the country.
こういった施設に入れてる人は、
So the people who can stay this facility, they are lucky one. In Setagaya City, there are almost 1,000 people who have to stay at home, although they need care.
And what about your own plans one day when you're elderly? Have you thought about that?
考えてません。考えてないです。
I haven't think about it yet.
If the guy who runs the nursing home isn't thinking about it, who is? In Japan, it used to be common for families to live together, but now the traditional family structure is crumbling. More people are living alone, which leads to another problem. There's even a word in Japanese for it.
Kodokushi. Kodokushi is the Japanese word.
Kodokushi means lonely death. When you die alone and no one finds your body for days or even weeks. Takamasa Fujiwara is with the Tokyo Council for Social Welfare, a nonprofit that matches volunteers with activities.
So in Tokyo, 4,000 senior citizens die along each year. So that means about 10 people per day.
Seniors are dying alone. Japan is out of workers and uncomfortable with foreigners. But there is one last option. Enter the robots.
Did Robear just bow to us?
Yes, yes.
Robear is about 4 feet tall. He's blue and white, has long arms, and looks like he just rolled out of a Disney movie. Dr. Toshoharu Mukai helped develop him. He says the government wants to design robots for nursing care. But he says if you are imagining shiny robots taking care of smiling seniors, think again. The technology just isn't there yet.
Actually, it is very difficult. We have made many robots, but few of them are really useful. So that is problem.
Dr. Mukai says it's not easy to design a robot that understands when a fragile elderly patient flinches or doesn't want to be picked up out of bed. Robear is made of plastic and metal, and like a real bear, he could do damage to a human. People as caregivers are amazing products.
Yes. Yeah, humans are very special. It's difficult to get function over humans.
Dr. Mukai says one day robots will be able to do jobs like lifting or moving patients, maybe in about 10 years. Mikiko Yamazaki is president of the Tokyo Voluntary Action Center. She says in the meantime, loneliness and isolation are a problem for the seniors left on their own.
In their diary, they write, I'm so lonely today, every day. Or they write, nobody visit me today again. That kind of very sad diary they keep.
The government, Yamazaki says, provides pensions and health insurance, services that cover older Japanese. She says they have monetary support, but what the country lacks is people. In Tokyo, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Sally's story came to us through a collaboration with the international radio and multimedia project Bending Borders. She took a bunch of great pictures and video in that nursing home while she was there, including some of the Robear in action. Get it, Robear. It's all at marketplace.org. All All right, this final note on the way out today, one more Japan item. You know how we always say follow the bond market if you want to know where an economy is going? Here with the yield on the Japanese long bond today, the 30-year bond, 0.458%. That is, you lend the Japanese government money for 30 years in exchange for twice-yearly payments equal to 0.485% of what you put up. In other words, basically nothing. It is worth a note here, though, that if you buy the Japanese 10-year, you actually have to pay for that privilege. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tomorrow is another day, y'all. We'll see you then. This is APM.